Good afternoon, please be seated. On behalf of the court, I want to welcome students from Lakeland Union High School. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. These students are here with the program cleverly entitled Court with Class. It's a program sponsored by the State Bar in this court. Students from around the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. If they accept the invitation, they are sent materials about the case we are about to hear and join us for the oral argument. They also meet with a justice of this court who's been assigned for that day, and the discussion is the procedures of the court in accepting a case and deciding a case, not the substantive issues of the case. The Lakeland Union High School students met earlier today with Justice Bradley for the discussion. So we want to welcome them all again. Now, if anyone here does not have a summary of the case we're about to hear, if you raise your hand, we will give you a summary. It's easier to listen to the oral argument if you know a bit about the facts and law. Good. Anyone else want a summary? Got two more. Thank you. Let me introduce the court to you all. Seated to my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. The students have already met her during the lunch hour. To her right is Justice David Prosser, and on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. To his immediate left, Justice Patience Rogensack. And on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I'll call our third case today, 07-18-900-CR, State versus Michael A. Littlejohn, arguing on behalf of the state. I'm sorry, arguing on behalf of Michael Littlejohn is William Schmall of the Office of State Public Defender. Mr. Schmall, you may proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is William Schmall, and I represent Michael Littlejohn. The issue presented in this case is very similar to a case that was heard this morning, and I will tell you in advance that I was present during the oral argument this morning, and I will try to alter my own remarks so that we are not unduly repetitive. But the issue concerns the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution, which protects citizens against unreasonable searches and seizures, and it also concerns the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution, which provides that the government ordinarily cannot profit from evidence that it obtains through unreasonable searches. Of course, the Wisconsin Constitution has parallel provisions. In short, Mr. Littlejohn had parked his automobile in the parking lot of his apartment building, locked the door behind him. He had begun walking to his apartment when he was confronted by police officers. The police officers learned that Mr. Littlejohn's operating privileges were revoked, so they placed him under arrest for that offense. They handcuffed him, secured him in the patrol car under the direct supervision of another officer. At that point, the officers conducted a warrantless search of Mr. Littlejohn's locked automobile using Mr. Littlejohn's keys. The officers admitted that they did not have any reason to believe any evidence of any offense would be found in the car at the time they began the search. The circuit court granted a motion to suppress evidence, in effect ruling that the evidence had been obtained unreasonably and the government could not profit from it. Subsequently, the Court of Appeals reversed that ruling and indicated that it believed a decision of the Wisconsin Supreme Court gave the officers a reasonable basis upon which to rely. Now, I should note the timing of this is the search occurred before the United States Supreme Court's recent ruling in Arizona versus Gant, and the Court of Appeals decision also occurred before the decision in Gant. And the state is now arguing that although the search was unreasonable and in violation of the Constitution under the recent ruling in Gant, this court should nevertheless allow the government to profit from the evidence that obtained.
Let me just say, my assumption is that if the search was before Gant, the Court of Appeals before Gant, but Gant is about the cases here after Gant, that it's viewed as in the pipeline.
Yes.
Okay.
That's correct. Just like the case this morning, Dearborn, the petition for review had been filed, and it was held in abeyance by the Supreme Court for, in my experience, a rather lengthy period of time. But this is still in the direct appeal pipeline. Now, I want to briefly touch on a few questions before trying to turn the page to something completely different than the court heard this morning. I completely adopt all of the arguments that were raised on behalf of Mr. Dearborn this morning concerning the application of the retroactivity rule in this case. I'm not going to repeat all of those. I do want to emphasize a couple brief points, though. First of all, this is not just a rule of the United States Supreme Court. In a case called State versus Koch, K-O-C-H, the Wisconsin Supreme Court agreed that the retroactivity rule, in effect, supersedes all of the policy reasons behind a good faith exception. So it's my position that there is no tension, that any tension between the good faith exception and the retroactivity rule has been resolved more than 20 years ago. And one, a reasonable legal mind cannot read United States versus Johnson and come to a different opinion. The state's argument, however, about that would mean that the retroactivity rule would be superfluous in Fourth Amendment cases. And indeed, in future Gantt-type cases, even Mr. Gant himself would not get any remedy. One last thing on the retroactivity rule, as set forth by the argument in opposition to the retroactivity rule and the authorities that have been cited by the Attorney General in his written argument. The essential and fundamental legal error in those arguments, in those cases, is the mixing and matching of legal rules and principles from different contexts. What I mean by that is the language taken from good faith exception cases basically all comes from warrant cases where the search is presumed to be lawful and the search is treated with great favor by the legal system. In contrast, this case, Mr. Littlejohn's case, involves a warrantless search, which is presumed unreasonable under the 14th Amendment. And I submit it is a fundamental and elementary error in legal reasoning to take principles from search warrant cases and try to fit them in a non-warrant case. Now, before I turn, there were a few questions that were asked in the morning session in the Dearborn case. Whether counsel believed Dearborn and Littlejohn stand essentially on the same footing. In my opinion, they probably do. The only meaningful difference that I can discern is that Mr. Littlejohn did obtain a suppression order from the circuit court. I'm not sure that that really makes any difference, but it's there, and to some extent, I suppose it improves his position a little. Okay, with the court's permission, I'm going to turn and try to show that there are, if we could set aside the retroactivity rule and somehow ignore that, and I believe it's binding, so we can't, but if we could, I would like to show you that there are some severe problems in the reasoning of the state's argument. The whole thing relating to a police officer objectively relying on judicial pronouncements. The first point I'd like to make there is that what were the police officers in this case? What judicial pronouncement were they relying on? When we talk about objective reliance, I think what we mean is something that can be pointed to objectively that everyone can see. Well, there weren't any sentences in the Belton, New York versus Belton opinion that concerned locked vehicles or secured and handcuffed motorists. So the police couldn't have been objectively relying on Belton, I don't think. What about Fry? Well, where did Fry get that locked glove compartment? Let me back up. Fry did not actually even concern a locked vehicle, although it did concern a locked glove compartment. So if we want to be strict about it, I don't think Fry is even precedent that can be relied on, in this case, against Mr. Littlejohn or against Mr. Dearborn.
Counsel, I have not carefully followed the trail of analysis. In Gantt, they talk about Justice Brennan's, I think, misconstruction of the Belton holding and how that, and then they reference Justice O'Connor's, and how that has unfolded throughout the states and the federal judiciary. My question is, regardless of whether or not some of those words appear in Belton, apparently that's the way it was taught, it is asserted in the opinion, for 28 years. So if that's correct, isn't there objective reliance?
My first point would be that it wasn't universally taught that way. It wasn't universally the determination of courts that that's what Belton held. And it, so that gets into a situation, well, which court is the police officer going to rely on? But to come more to your the point of your question, widespread misunderstanding alone does not create an objectively reasonable reliance. It isn't an excuse to violate the law or the Constitution just because other people do it too. There has to be something more, something that you can point to that makes that widespread misunderstanding reasonable. And you can't find it in Belton. And whether it's persuasive to us or not now, the High Court said in Gantt that it wasn't overruling anything, that that's always been the law. In other words, Gantt is not a new rule. The other point I wanted to make about Fry, however, is that the Fry Court changed things a little bit with respect to the reaching distance test as well, saying that as long as Mr. Fry remained at the scene, whatever that means, that that was sufficient to satisfy the reaching distance test. Well, I don't think that's exactly correct either. So were the police officers in this case relying on Belton or on Fry? Now, there's an additional wrinkle here. Before Fry, the Wisconsin Supreme Court had issued a decision in a case called Soley versus State, which is cited in my written brief, where the individual's car had been locked. The person was arrested outside of their car. And this court held that that locked car could not support an entry incident to lawful arrest. Now, the interesting thing is that Soley was not briefed in State versus Fry. It was not argued by the parties, and it was not addressed by the Supreme Court. But some years later, this court again had a case called State versus Tompkins, which is also cited in the briefs. Tompkins also held that a locked pickup truck where the person was arrested more than arm's distance away, did not support a search of the interior of the truck pursuant to arrest of the motorist. Now, there's a conflict there that it isn't clear how to resolve it, and I'm a lawyer of more than 30 years' experience. How is a police officer supposed to do that? How can we say that that officer can choose State v. Frye and rely on it and ignore Soley v. State and State v. Tompkins? So the hierarchy of courts themselves gives us, to me, an unanswerable question, unless we say that we can only rely, police can only objectively, reasonably rely on the United States Supreme Court's pronouncements. Because after all, the United States Supreme Court is the final arbiter of what the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution means. One can imagine many situations. Sure.
You would expect police officers to rely on Arizona versus Gant, wouldn't you?
No, not at all. Gant applies by virtue of, for the future, yes, they must rely on Gant. That's correct.
Okay. And Gant talks about searches incident to arrest.
Yes.
And it authorizes those searches to some extent.
Reaffirms the old rules, correct.
Okay, and there are some conditions for those searches. For example, if there are people running around, they're not in the back of a squad car, they're not sort of handcuffed or anything. Wouldn't you expect the officers to take that into account?
Sure, that presents a different situation.
And if there is a, if someone is arrested for offense A, and there's good reason to believe that evidence of offense A would be in the automobile or the motor vehicle, that's sort of different. I mean, that's a factor that the officers have to take into account, isn't it?
Gant authorized a search of a vehicle when the police have probable cause to believe evidence will be found in the vehicle.
Why is it that police officers should rely on Gant, but they shouldn't rely on, say, Belton?
Well, I think they should have relied on Belton. In my view, Belton would not have supported what the police did in this case.
And what about Frye?
Frye does not either, in my opinion, because Frye does not address a locked vehicle. And Frye conflicts to some extent with Belton by going into, you know, by setting up a situation of a secured motorist and a locked vehicle or a locked compartment in Frye, actually. So I don't understand, if you're going to say the officer could objectively rely on one of those, how does he or she choose? That's my point.
Well, I think the Gant case is going to be open to interpretation over the years. But, I mean, you've got some outlines, and Belton was interpreted in hundreds of cases in a way that's probably consistent with what happened here.
I would agree with that.
Okay. Why is it you can rely on, or you expect the police to rely on some cases, but, oh, when they rely on other cases, oh, can't do that?
Because the conflict between Belton and Frye resulted in an equivocal and ambiguous rule of law. Right now, Gant, at least, is fairly clear as a pronouncement of law as to what it means. And it might be, as you point out, that in future situations with different facts than are presented here today, there will become an ambiguous situation. When that happens, the thrust of my argument is the police should not have the authority to decide what the applicable rule of law is. They should go and request a search warrant, because that is what is the one thing that stands between government overreaching and the people. If the police have an opportunity to get a search warrant, as they did here, They should go and do that. That's what we're trying to deter, is the police taking it upon themselves to extrapolate from previous cases and decide for themselves what the Fourth Amendment means. Now, there might be circumstances, I'll concede, in which the action is hot and heavy. The police officer can't go and get a warrant. That's not the situation here today either, and that might be a different situation. Have I addressed?
Well, let's say I that's Justice Ziegler. Do I have probable cause to search her?
Well, you haven't told me very many facts. What I would say,
if
you simply have probable cause to arrest her, probably not.
She has a lead foot. I'm an officer. I stop her on the highway. I'm very close to her now. Do I have cause to search her?
Probable cause, I would say no.
I wouldn't be able to get an arrest warrant then.
I misunderstood. Didn't you say that you just arrested her for speeding?
Yeah.
You don't need a warrant then if you observed the violation.
No, that's certainly true. But what I'm trying to get at is that I don't think the search incident arrest is you're not going to always be able to get a search warrant. Yeah, the search incident arrest is an exception to probable cause, really. Isn't it?
It's a different warrant exception than a probable cause search. A probable cause search is also a warrant exception. I mean, if we're talking about a moving vehicle.
Well, search incident to arrest, what are you doing? You're searching for the protection of the law enforcement officers? That's one reason you're searching?
Yes, we're either searching to protect the law officers from weapons by the arrested person or to prevent them from destroying evidence of the offense for which they're being arrested.
That's right.
But I think what I'm trying to get at is this. I am close enough after this arrest that I can search her incident to an arrest. But if I'm where the chief is sitting, I can't search her.
I think that's what GAMP stands for. Yes.
Oh, all right.
Oh, well. Hey, listen. If you think you have reasonable suspicion that I have a knife or a gun, I think you can search me. But if my hands are tied, my feet are tied, and I'm on the ground unconscious, you got another problem. So I think you have to be very careful with that, because that's why we just said, why can you search incident to an arrest, right?
Yes.
Danger to the officer or evidence there that you have to pick up.
Yes.
All I'm saying is the probable cause to search is not always going to be present. You can't always say, well, just go and get a search warrant. That isn't going to work.
I agree. I think if the police had gone and asked for a search warrant, in this case, they would have been turned down. And then we would know that that search could not be performed.
Mr. Littlejohn were still in the car, however.
What he was in the police car, yes.
Yeah, I mean, his car, his truck, or whatever it was.
No, Mr. Littlejohn was
out. No, the question was if.
If he were still in his car.
Yeah.
Then I think Gant and Belton and Schimmel would all authorize a search of the vehicle. Is that what you're asking?
But no probable cause.
I assumed that you were asking if he were being arrested for an offense.
Yeah.
And he were still in the car.
Yeah.
Yes.
He could be arrested for probable cause or for violation, right?
Yes.
There could be a search incident to an arrest, right?
Yes.
But for what reason? One, to protect the officer. So if the officer thought he had a gun or a knife, he could be searched. If they thought there was a gun or knife on the seat, right?
Yes.
Or in the glove compartment, which he could reach.
I am
moving you. I'm going to get you into the trunk. Got it?
I think.
All right. But the point is it a danger, right? They
can
search incident to arrest, right?
Is there a reasonable?
And they can search for contraband.
Yes.
So if they can search, they don't need probable cause for the search. They need these two items.
They need an arrest and they need reaching distance. Somebody who has actual access to the vicinity.
We had a case, I think it was at Poppenhagen, where they arrested the guy in his house. They took him out. He was on his way to the police station. They went back into the house and they searched the bedroom and they searched under the bed. And the court said, it's not a search incident to arrest.
And not Poppenhagen.
Poppenhagen, but I think I wrote it myself. And I got three people to join it. It's best I remember. It was a brilliant case.
I
held for the defendant, so I assume that you were in favor of that case.
I can't recall it all. I only have a few minutes left for my primary argument. I just want to mention a few more of the problems.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to interrupt you. Why are we talking about objective police thought? What?
Reasonably.
Yeah, reasonably. Why are we talking about that?
Because the state in opposition has suggested that this court adopt a new good faith exception for judicial pronouncements.
Okay.
And that good faith
exception
rests upon objectively.
Because it was out of my realm of understanding, but you're objecting to this new test. Okay, good. Got it.
Okay. A couple other problems. You know, what if there is no Wisconsin court decision that's been published on whatever situation presents the officers, but they've got a case from the state of Minnesota and a case from the state of Illinois? Which one do they choose? Can they choose either one? Or do they have to say, we don't have a rule? Dictum and the other limitations on court opinions. This state has a very difficult to understand process for evaluating what a judicial pronouncement actually means. What I mean by that is this court has said that dictum in a court's decision is not controlling. And by that I mean something that was not essential to the court's decision. But then we also have a rule that says if the court makes a deliberate pronouncement that's germane to the issue before the court, that should be treated as a pronouncement of law. Well, police officers can't be expected to understand those nuances. To say that they can pick and choose there, ultimately the problem is that relying on judicial pronouncements by the police does not put any check and balance between the officers and the Fourth Amendment rights. When there's a warrant, the preferred situation, a neutral magistrate has acted as a check on the police officers for the specific facts at issue. Even when there's a statute, the legislature has acted as a check and balance against what the police officers do. The collective wisdom of the legislature decides what the police can do. But if we tell the police they can just sift and winnow through judicial pronouncements, decide for themselves what is the operative rule of law, and take action without seeking a warrant, even when they have an opportunity to do one, I think the protections of the Fourth Amendment would be lost. Doing the Fourth Amendment correctly is sometimes unpopular, but it's necessary to preserve our liberties. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schmal. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Lossy, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. It's a big day for you, two in a row.
Indeed, Chief Justice, and I have two friends to sort of carry me out of here when I'm done with the second one. I, too, would not like to step back into retroactivity. I've had enough of that for one day. Following in conclusion. I reread the cases that my adversary this morning mentioned. It does support her argument. It is not anywhere near as absolute as she makes it out to be, in my opinion. They just don't go that far. They allow one to argue. They don't make it that absolute or in any respect say that the limitations on the exclusionary rule or the good faith exception are automatically trumped by the retroactivity doctrine. And the other thing is, despite the fact that I don't feel like I was able to articulate an equally cerebral rebuttal this morning, three circuits, the 10th, the 11th, and the 6th, have rejected that. And they're all smarter than I am. I mean the 6th.
I wouldn't concede that, counsel.
No, I'm not sure it's
true. Let's not concede that, counsel.
Oh, well, okay. I add the 6th because one of the cases that the appellants in these two cases rely on is Peoples out of Michigan, a district court case. And Peoples, ironically, finds that there is no good, should be no new good faith exception for reliance on judicial precedent, but it adamantly rejects the retroactivity doctrine. That's why I cited to it also. And in the course of rejecting the retroactivity as mandating finding no good faith exception, the People's Court cites to a Sixth Circuit case, Lopez. And Lopez said that finding a violation of the right and the then finding an appropriate remedy are separate questions. And the People's Court just says that one solution is what the Sixth Circuit does in Lopez. It remands for a remedy. It just doesn't deal with it. All three of these circuits accept the fact, accept as law, right or wrong, that the remedy doesn't flow with the Declaration of Rights, and that because the Supreme Court's issuance of certiorari was solely on the issue of the legitimacy of the search, that it's not a major issue. They grant retroactivity. It just has nothing to do with the remedy because the Supreme Court did not pass on that.
You're not suggesting we remand for a remedy.
No, Justice, I guess I'm not. I'm not clear how that would work, but it did.
Just a certain, the trial court or a court of appeals would be faced with the same legal issue
exactly.
We are faced with.
Exactly.
Counsel, you talk about the federal circuit courts. What about the Danforth case that has been submitted to us? It seems to suggest that whether a violation of a right that occurred prior to the announcement of a new rule will entitle a criminal defendant to the relief sought. That's what they mean by retroactivity rather than something with regard to the temporal nature. Have you had an opportunity to take a look at the Danforth case? That it wasn't cited in the briefs, but it was provided on supplemental authority, I think.
Justice, precursorily, I did. I didn't fully appreciate the point you raised, and I thought what the case stands for is that state courts can apply retroactively more broadly in favor of the aggrieved person than mandated under federal law. In the context of a habeas corpus.
Yeah, I also discerned that, but it seemed to be addressing that whether a violation of the right that occurred prior to the announcement of the new rule will entitle a criminal defendant to the relief sought, you know, which is here, suppression, and that I thought it was being submitted and read for the premise that Little John is entitled to the relief sought, just like Gant got, which is, of course, suppression given by the Supreme Court of the state of Arizona.
I'm afraid I can't give you a better answer to that. I simply don't know the answer to it, and a rather weak response to your question would be, then what about Herring, which was 2 years later, that said no future
Danforth
deterrence, no exclusion.
Danforth was 2009. No, eight.
Eight.
Okay. But after Herring?
Before.
Danforth is before Herring?
Yes.
And Herring is the case that involves the information from another department, and the accuracy of the information was called into question. Negligence?
The second police department, the non-arresting police department, erroneously reported that there was an arrest warrant out, mm-hmm. when in fact it had been withdrawn months before.
And the court said it was isolated and attenuated, if
correct.
I recall.
Now, the general rule is that someone who brings the case and gets it to the U.S. Supreme Court first gets the advantage, and so in Gant, is the evidence is suppressed, right?
My understanding, Chief Justice, yes, is that it was suppressed by the Arizona Supreme
right.
Court.
And on federal constitutional issues, otherwise it would have never gotten to the U.S. Supreme Court.
I'm sorry, what?
On federal constitutional grounds, otherwise it would not have gone to the U.S. Supreme Court.
I believe that's true.
So, the result of your argument is that everyone else but Gant gets the advantage of the Gant decision.
I'm sorry, you mean that...
Right? Gant gets the evidence suppressed.
Correct.
But Littlejohn, who just didn't happen to reach the U.S. Supreme Court first, or as a companion case, you don't want to give him the result, that is, the substantive rule of Gant.
That's correct, Chief Justice.
So only Gant gets it, and everyone who is arrested after Gant.
Yes, they would too.
Why is that fair? Why shouldn't Gant get the result if you're not going to give it to Littlejohn?
I don't think, Chief Justice, I could give you an answer that would satisfy you, but I could put it in a different context as to how we look at it.
All right.
Assume, just for the sake of argument, it's at least viable that we'll get a good faith exception out of reliance on clear-cut judicial precedent. It's an issue.
Why didn't Gant get a good faith exception for him? The court could have said, look, this is a bad Belton case. Belton is okay law, but everybody except a few people have construed it too broadly and incorrectly. And in Gant, we now clean up Belton. But, Mr. Gant, you're not going to, your evidence is not going to be suppressed because it's good faith. Everybody except the state Supreme Court in Arizona said Gant should lose. All the circuits said that, state courts said that. So it's good faith. Why didn't the court apply good faith in Gant?
To the best of my knowledge, Chief Justice, it's because they didn't ask for it. And that would be my point. The only answer I can give you that comes close, even if not satisfactory. Gant got a windfall because nobody asked.
Did you check the briefs?
I did not.
Okay. I will.
Okay.
All right. You think it was a windfall because the AG's office in Arizona wasn't smart enough to ask for it.
I wouldn't use those words in a number of...
I withdraw them. That's okay.
In a number of cases, I myself, have focused on the heart of the issue and didn't worry about collateral defenses, being confident we were going to win on that. And then if you don't, it's too late.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But, yes... I think Gant got a windfall, and fairness doesn't require that everybody else get a windfall.
Sure. Okay. You think that the U.S. Supreme Court just goofed too?
Well, they granted cert on the only question presented to them. I don't think...
Okay. And the question then to see what the petition for cert put in. Okay,
correct.
We'll check that too.
Right. That's...
Did it go back to Gant? I left that file again and...
That
did it go back to the Arizona Supreme Court for good faith or just suppressed?
To my knowledge, it just ended with the
okay.
Supreme Court.
Yeah.
I did check Keysight in the course of writing this brief, and there was no new activity on it.
Uh-huh.
That's not to say there couldn't be very recently.
Other thing to do is see what the Arizona Supreme Court did with a good faith, if that was argued before them, too.
Right.
Okay.
I believe, Chief Justice, that in Davis, this case I sent a letter on last Thursday, that the Davis judge writing the case said that they checked the Supreme, the Arizona paperwork, and that nobody ever dealt with good faith.
Pardon?
No one. That in the Davis case, 11th Circuit, they said that good faith wasn't dealt with in Gantt at all. And my memory is that I'm reading it for proceedings in Arizona as well as proceedings in the U.S. Supreme Court.
Good. We'll check that.
Right. Another issue I'd like to respond to is this notion that the police could not reasonably rely on judicial pronouncements. I don't think that is a persuasive argument for a number of reasons. We do accept Gantt as the law of the land, but yet at the same time, the dissent, including the Chief Justice, said they overruled it. Well, frankly, I think most of the people who have ever read the decision think they overruled it and just don't acknowledge it. This is further supported by the fact that the court, after saying it's not our fault you misinterpreted it, but maybe you misinterpreted it because of what we said in the Justice Brennan's dissent or concurrence, whatever it was, in Belton, and you folks especially misinterpreted it after Thornton came down from us. The court's equivocating there, and I think as a matter of acknowledging reality, they simply pulled the rug out from under the police after 28 years of what was thought to be essentially a bright line. More than that, though, this court in Frye, Dank, Pallone did believe it to be a bright line and articulated that in Frye. I don't think it's at all valid to argue that Frye is an iffy decision the police shouldn't have relied on. And in fact, in his petition for review, petitioner Littlejohn says there was a bright line absolutely binding on the courts, and that's that. Well, if it's absolutely binding on the Court of Appeals, absolutely binding on the magistrate he would have had the police go to for a search warrant, it's absolutely binding. This issue, too, was dealt with in the Davis opinion, where the court said if it's a matter of the police relying on a crystal clear, ironclad precedent of the highest court in the jurisdiction, that's totally different than forum shopping, opinion shopping, parsing majority opinions from dissents. And I believe that to be the case here. Frye gave us a well-reasoned rule of law based upon the prevailing interpretation of Thornton and Belton for 28 years by almost everyone west of Greenland. And the fact that the Supreme Court has now declared it gone and has declared that it was someone else's misinterpretation is fine, something we accept and live with. But nonetheless, there was absolutely no police misconduct in any of this or misstep. Ironically, the police would have been following Frye because they are so well-trained, which meets one of this court's additional criteria for the good faith exception enunciated in Neeson, explained in Marquardt. And also, this leads to the issue of the magistrate would have been in the same position as Mr. Littlejohn says the police were, you know, as if he ascribes to them that they reasoned through all this and they're reading the cases. It would have made no difference to go to a magistrate who would have said, oh, yep, Frye, go ahead. Now, they either did or didn't have to get a warrant, but yet there is something of a reality check to looking to see what difference it would have made. And that leads to the point that to say that there should be, in limited circumstances, a good faith exception for police reliance on crystal clear precedent in the highest court is not all that unrelated from relying on a statute. And the Supreme Court relied on a statute in Kroll. we see great similarities there. Absent any more questions, that really is the sum and the substance between these two cases of the state's position, and I would have nothing else to add.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Hold on.
Neely made it. Justice Prosser.
Griffith versus Kentucky.
I'm sorry, what?
Griffith versus Kentucky.
Yes.
Does that apply to all constitutional rules?
To the best of my understanding, it does, Justice. It's just we would hearken back to what the court said in Davis, McCain, Lopez, Peoples. The only effect it has here was the actual ruling. The actual question before the U.S. Supreme Court was the search legal or not. It had nothing to do with remedy.
In the brief of Ms. Hirsch this morning, there is reference to the desist case.
Yes.
And a three-part test in that case, which apparently has been superseded by Griffith versus Kentucky, is that right?
Correct, Justice.
But we don't really know, do we, what the justices in Griffith versus Kentucky would have done if they had been confronted with good faith exceptions?
No, we don't.
Is it possible to examine some of the factors that go back to desist to help us on this?
Insofar as the court is willing to accept what I stated this morning, that this is sort of policy of what this court is going to do with the Wisconsin Constitution. Or, of course, this court is the final law as in far as interpreting the federal constitution and federal law too, but most importantly the Wisconsin, and if it gives any additional protections. Yes, I think those factors are very important if one is to consider the social policy effects, that is specifically reliance. The Gantt court itself said for 28 years police have relied on this. It was the majority opinion in Gantt that said it's taught that way in police academies. And also the effect on other cases, the effect on the administration of justice. I believe those are appropriate factors.
Well, the factors, I'm just quoting from desist here. Exclusion of electronic eavesdropping evidence seized before CATS would increase the burden on the administration of justice. One. Would overturn convictions based on fair reliance upon pre-CATS decisions, two, and would not serve to deter similar searches and seizures in the future. It seems to me you have emphasized the third point and to some extent the heavy reliance, that's the second point. Can you speak anything more about the if there is a burden on the administration of justice?
That sort of gets to your question this morning in the Dearborn case, Justice, about how many cases are there like this. And I did happen to talk to my unit director, Greg Weber. He said it simply wouldn't be fair for him to speculate. He said he's gotten dozens of cases of calls from DAs inquiring about this, but he cannot honestly say these are going to become cases that are going to burden the system. And he, too, could only think that we have, I don't know, less than half a dozen in the Court of Appeals right now and wasn't quite sure how many others would come down the line. It certainly would be something of a burden to have to reopen it, reopen cases like this on Dearborn, Little John, other cases that might come along, because I simply have no way of knowing how many others there are where they simply haven't started any legal action. But I just can't in good conscience overstate that. I'm thinking more in terms of it would be in the benefit of the administration of justice, in my view, in our view, to expand the whole concept of a good faith exception or the non-applicability of the exclusionary rule to something like this, where the police are well trained and relying directly on the pronouncement of the highest court in their jurisdiction.
Well, let me raise this point. If there is an arrest of someone and that person is put in the back of a squad car, and then there's a search of the person's vehicle, you can pretty much say Belton, Fry, or at least in the past, and analysis kind of stops after that point. But, for example, in the Pallone case, Belton was cited, but there was a whole separate argument why search of the vehicle was permitted. It seems to me there could be other justifications for some of the searches of these vehicles that had been approved simply by saying Belton, Fry.
I'm quite sure that's true, Justice. I just have no way of assessing that. I remember in Pallone, I think it was Pallone, or maybe it was Dink when I raised it, that you also have the issue as if there's probable cause, because it's a car search, an issue that affects officer safety is how many officers are there, how many subjects in the other car are there. Because in the Denk case, the driver was arrested, but the passenger wasn't. Certainly, there are other exceptions that could apply in these cases, and unless particular cases are put in front of us, we'll never know what they would be or how they would play out. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Schmall, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I will take the opportunity to address some of the questions that have been raised to the Attorney General. First, Madam Chief Justice, it is my understanding that the good faith exception was not argued in Arizona versus Gantt. I have not looked at the briefs for myself. I have reviewed the Arizona court's opinion. However, that doesn't make any difference in my view, because the ruling in Gantt did not adopt a new good faith exception. And under the retroactivity rule, everyone in the pipeline gets the same remedy as Gantt. Gantt did receive suppression. No good faith exception case in the U.S. Supreme Court has ever addressed or rejected the policies and reasons for the retroactivity rule. Second, Justice Prosser, you asked whether Griffith applies to all newly announced rules of criminal procedure, not just the Fourth Amendment, is the way I interpreted your question. I think it does. And the effect, if the Attorney General's argument were accepted, would be that retroactivity would never apply to Fourth Amendment cases because of their brand new good faith exception. But in Danforth, where the question was retroactivity of a confrontation issue under the Sixth Amendment, there could be retroactivity. Now, how do you logically do that discrimination? I do honestly believe that if you look at Johnson, which was the predecessor to Griffith, it did specifically address concerns such as police reliance, letting the guilty go free because the constable blundered, and the effect on the criminal justice system. It expressly and specifically addressed those and found those interests to be inferior to the interest in having all appellants in the direct appeal pipeline be treated equally. Now, that's a binding authority. That isn't Circuit Court of Appeals opinions that are not binding in any way on this court except for persuasive value. The U.S. Supreme Court is binding on this court as a matter of the retroactivity rule. Once again, I'd like to suggest that it's a mistake, and an elementary mistake, to try to take language and rules and principles from search warrant cases in which the search is treated with favor and good faith exception exists, and try to plug those in to a warrantless search case. My colleague, Mr. Losey, during his argument, said several times that the officers in this case followed a clear-cut precedent, something to that effect. Well, he didn't mention what precedent says the police could go into a locked vehicle. He didn't address Soli. He didn't address Tompkins. And he didn't point to anything in Belton that says the police can go into a locked vehicle after the motorist has left that vehicle. There was a comment, I think it was in response to a question, that the Attorney General views the Crawl case and statutes as somehow akin to this case. I just don't see that, because a statute doesn't create the situation that Griffith was worried about, of unequal treatment among appellants. The statute's constitutional. One day it applies to everybody. It's held unconstitutional. It doesn't apply to anybody. There aren't anybody in a pipeline that are treated unequally. That's all I have to say, unless there are additional questions. I see I have a little bit of time.
How about Danforth?
I maintain, as Ms. Hirsch did this morning, that Danforth says that the retroactivity rule means the same remedy is applicable. That was a retroactivity case. I agree it wasn't a Fourth Amendment case. It was a Sixth Amendment case, a confrontation case. But the language of the majority there, which we supplied to the court in a letter last week, I don't know how you could interpret it any differently. And that's a binding authority as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Small. Thank you, Mr. Olasi, for the arguments this afternoon. And we appreciate that both counsel were here this morning, took the earlier arguments and questions into consideration, and then moved in so it was not repetitive, but dealt with issues that were raised earlier this morning that are similarly raised in this case. This concludes our hearing on 07-AP-900-CR, State versus Littlejohn. Court will meet in closed conference at 3. The court is in recess until Thursday morning at 9:45 for oral argument. We are in recess.